Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just because the numbers aren't enough, how about a little physics to go with your stock market today? What goes up? You know the rest. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 22nd of January, 2013, or as we have taken to referring to it around here, the 1,780th day of the bull market. The fifth anniversary of the post-Lehman low is just around the corner. That was 6,447 on the Dow, the 9th of March of '09, which means, well, you know what that means, right? Today's lead story, which comes with the caption, "Look out below," is by Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
For a true correction to happen, the stock market has to drop at least 10%. That would mean the Dow Jones Industrial Average would have to fall 1,600 points. Alec Young is a global equity strategist with S&P Capital IQ. He says, historically speaking, we're about due for a fall.
The S&P 500 has averaged a correction every 18 months, and currently, we haven't had one since 2011, so we're about 28 months overdue.
Still, the economy is in uncharted territory, says Max Wolf, chief economist at ZT Wealth.
The rally is long in the tooth, but it is also a unique circumstance on a lot of levels.
Even so, Wolf also expects a correction. He says unemployment is high, economic growth has been slow, and then there's the Federal Reserve. It's been pumping billions into our economy every month for years. It's hard to know what will happen as the Fed slows down that stimulus.
We're about to see over the next 6 months how much of the market's rally was Fed policy and how much of the market's rally is the economy. And that makes everybody nervous, and it should.
But a correction would probably not turn into a crash, says Gary Thayer with Wells Fargo Advisors. He says corporate earnings are strong and most companies' stock is not overvalued if you look at how much they're taking in.
So we're expecting it would just be a temporary pullback in the market, not a reversal of the trend.
So even if the market's bull run is over, we don't necessarily have to brace for the bears. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I think that was an unauthorized use of the wah-wah trombones, by the way. I'm going to have a word with Ms. Vanek Smith. All right, as long as we are talking about stocks, shares of Expedia, the online travel site, have had a rough week, off about 3.5% since Monday. It's a Google thing. A company that measures search metrics, called, cleverly enough, search metrics, says the traffic that Expedia is getting from Google search results is way, way down. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
So what's going on here, man, with Expedia? Because it's not like people aren't searching for travel anymore.
No. We still all want to travel. Right. But Expedia's website lost 25% of its visibility in Google search term results this month alone. And what this is basically a reminder that Google, you know, they may be doing self-driving cars, they may be investing in robotics, but at the end of the day, they can end you on the internet.
So this, you know, losing 25% is basically falling to page 19 in the search results, which nobody ever gets to.
Right. It's the digital version of Siberia.
We should say that neither Google nor Expedia is talking about what might have happened. Then how can we know what conceivably happened?
Yeah, we don't know yet, right? Neither company is talking. What may have happened, now we remember this a few weeks back, that website Rap Genius, which you go to look at all your Tupac lyrics, et cetera.
I do, all the time.
They tried to pay other websites, bloggers specifically, to link to their website in order to get Google to like their website more. And that resulted in the same kind of punishment that we may be seeing here with Expedia. But like you said, we don't quite know yet.
Does this affect Google in any way, or they're just doing what they do and it's OK if they're the 800-pound gorilla?
Well, here's the thing. Right now in Europe, Google is facing an antitrust case. And what's happening there is companies are basically accusing the search engine of demoting their websites and favoring Google's own similar options. Now, Google makes stuff, too. They make products on the internet. And there's actually been rumors that Google might be working on a price comparison tool for travel. Now, this is all early stages. These are rumors. But there may be more grumbling about Google's massive power on the internet and how it wields that power and whether it's fair. I mean, you and I, if we were going to do research on this story, what would we do?
I would Google it.
Yeah, I'd Google it too.
You know what I want you to do before we go, by the way?
Okay, sure.
I want you to go to Google, and you can do this after we get off the air. Google rap lyrics, Kai Ryssdal, Lupe Fiasco. Just do that. Ben Johnson, he hosts Marketplace Tech. We'll see you, Ben.
See you, Kai.
As I said, 1,780th day of the present bull market. Of course, not every one of those days was up. Maybe we'll ask Stacey Vanek Smith what music to use. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The National Labor Relations Board would like to have a little chat with Walmart. Last week, the NLRB issued its biggest complaint ever against the world's biggest retailer. It says the company fired or otherwise disciplined more than 60 people in 13 states for going on strike for higher pay. There will be a hearing on that eventually, but Walmart's labor woes go beyond just the American workforce. Employees in Walmart's growing number of stores in China are filing lawsuits against the company for the same kinds of things. Our China correspondent Rob Schmidt has that story.
In 1996, Walmart opened its first store in China in the southern city of Shenzhen. Wang Shishu was one of the company's first employees. He was hired to operate a dishwasher at the store's food court. His friends were jealous.
Everyone wanted to work there. I only got the job because back then, nobody in China knew how to operate a dishwasher. But I did.
Wang made a dollar an hour, a high salary in China at the time.
I could support my two children and my wife, and I covered our food and housing costs, too.
As China's economy rapidly developed, so too did the cost of living in China. But wages for China's Walmart employees lagged behind. China's economy is now 11 times bigger than it was 18 years ago when Walmart first arrived. In that same time, the starting salary for employees at Walmart in China has only gone up by 73 cents an hour. There's not much employees can do about it. The only workers' union allowed under Chinese law, the All-China Federation of Trade Unions, typically acts on behalf of company management rather than employees.
It's simply a boss's union, not a group that seeks justice for workers.
So in the summer of 2012, Wang collected dozens of worker signatures asking Walmart for better wages. A week after presenting the petition to Walmart and union officials, Walmart fired him. Wang sued Walmart, and in November, a Chinese court ruled in Wang's favor, ordering Walmart to rehire him. I meet Wang on the morning of his first day back at work, but an hour before he's scheduled to start, his lawyer calls. Walmart's just appealed the case.
They're probably going to try and negotiate a cash settlement, but I just want my job back.
China's always been crucial to Walmart's success. For decades, the country's cheap exports and quick supply chain helped the company maintain its low prices. Today, Walmart operates 390 stores like this one in more than 150 cities throughout China. It's a good match for China's shifting economy. The government wants to turn yesterday's factory workers into an army of restaurant, hotel, and retail employees. But Shenzhen labor lawyer He Yuancheng says Walmart needs to pay these workers a livable wage.
Only when all China's workers have money to spend will they actually consume more. If companies like Walmart don't pay workers enough, China's service sector won't grow.
He has handled dozens of worker complaints against Walmart. He says Walmart has a cozy relationship with the Chinese government's workers' union.
It's a win-win situation. The union gets tens of thousands of Walmart workers to join it, and Walmart can brag about having so-called unionized workers in China.
In response to a list of questions about how Walmart treats its workers in China, Kevin Gardner, Walmart's senior director of international corporate affairs, wrote in an email that no one at the company was available for an interview on this topic. Back in Shenzhen, another Walmart employee, Wang Yafeng, says after 11 years at the company, she took leave to attend a workers' rights march across the border in Hong Kong. She says after her manager saw her marching on the local television news, he fired her. When she threatened a lawsuit, she says Walmart officials scoffed at her chances.
They said they'd hired the best lawyers in the country and there was no chance I'd win.
A year later, Wang won her lawsuit against Walmart in a Chinese court. Walmart appealed the ruling twice. It lost each time. In the end, the company was forced to pay Wang 18 months of lost salary. The victory gave Wang a boost of confidence to go after a bigger target. Now, she says, she's suing China's government-backed union, too. In Shenzhen, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We are 5 days into the Sundance Film Festival underway in Park City, Utah. About 50,000 people will go to the mountains to watch documentaries and art house films. A somewhat smaller number are there to make deals, agents and studio executives looking for the next big hit. Wesley Morris is the film critic at Grantland, and more to the point, he is in Park City. Good to talk to you again, Wesley.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's happening?
Nada, man, but first of all, how's the skiing?
I don't ski. I got to tell you,
it is.
I know,
waste.
I know, I know. It is.
What a waste.
It's a crime. It's a crime that I don't ski. But
man, to the subject at hand, though, how are the movies? Are you seeing good stuff this time? Are you seeing good stuff from new people that you wouldn't see elsewhere?
Yes, I am. There are a lot more movies made by a lot more people doing a lot more interesting things than normal. I am noticing, though, as the festival winds on, there's a lot more money going into these films, these first and second films, and the technology helps a lot too. So you have these far more polished looking movies at this festival than you ever previously would have had.
But I thought Park City and Sundance was the place where people who made movies, you know, on a shoestring with a, I was about to say Betamax, but you know what I mean, go to you know, sort of hone their craft and get discovered.
I think the shoestrings are now like l'envers shoes. I mean, and you know, I've been hearing people talk about $10 million budgets and $11 million budgets, and anything with an X million dollar budget just seems astonishing to me, given how little money was spent to get movies made that were in this festival before.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a way in which what's happening in the sort of general consumer marketplace is really dictating the filmmaking choices of a lot of directors. And then at the same time, the programming sensibility of the festival, too.
Well, explain both those things. How's it affecting the directors and then what, you know, the festival puts on?
I don't think you can get away now with looking with a movie that looks like it was shot on a camera phone. I mean, despite the popularity of the Paranormal Activity movies, and
yeah,
which all came from the Blair Witch Project, which was a Sundance movie, I think the aesthetic bar is just higher now. And I think that in some ways, these directors aren't really making movies aimed at the audience like you and me.
Yeah.
They're talking to the executives and they're making movies that say to an executive, hey, I can make something that looks great. You know, because in some ways, this is really two festivals. This is a festival for the market and the business people. And it's a festival for people who want to experience something special. And there's a way in which I think the money and technology are risk compromising the sort of average festival goer experience.
Huh.
But it hasn't gotten quite to that point where a balance has been tipped.
How many of these films do you think we're going to see on the big screen in, you know, a year, 18 months?
I mean, Sundance, it used to be a feeding frenzy where people would come and buy everything. But I think that, you know, these are delicate flowers in a lot of ways, and you just can't buy them and throw them into a movie theater. You have to think about and strategize how to get an audience to want to see them.
We'll keep our eyes out. Wesley Morris, he writes on film for Grantland. Wesley, thanks a bunch. We got him, by the way, up, obviously, in Park City. Take it easy, man.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, Butterfingers cups. Anyone?
Reese's is the number one brand in the category, and they're going to do just fine.
Well, all right then. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 41 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 16,373. The NASDAQ advanced 17.4%. ended things at 42.43. The S&P 500 rose 1 point, up just a touch. Closed at 1844. Wait, that's 42.43 and then 1844. How about that? Semiconductor maker Advanced Micro Devices retreated 12% today after issuing a gloomy outlook for this quarter's revenue. Tech giant IBM clicked down more than 3% after fourth quarter revenues fell more than expected. Apple shone up 0.4%. I think it shined, actually. Activist investor Carl Icahn said he had raised his stake in the tech giant to more than $3 billion worth. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.86%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for December. The Conference Board issues its Index of Leading Economic Indicators, also for December. And it's National Pie Day. A pie-making tip from the American Pie Council. Read the recipe in its entirety before beginning. Hey, you want that flaky crust, don't you? Take the day off. Make it happen. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I get that the economy's changing, that creative destruction means a lot of companies that were once all that simply aren't anymore. That said, it's still worth a mention when one of them slips a few rungs farther down the ladder. Sears said this week it's going to close its flagship store in the heart of Chicago, its hometown. The rationale is familiar, a company cutting costs to stay relevant and to stay in business. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, boy, back in the day, Sears was something.
Sears and Roebuck put out its first catalog in the 1890s. You could buy a watch, jewelry, later on, saddles, sewing machines, silk stockings, even live singing canaries. Art Carden is an economics professor at Samford University's Brock School of Business.
The Sears catalog was a bit of a godsend for rural consumers.
Hello, consumer economy. The Sears catalog gave people easy access, good quality at good prices delivered to their doorstep.
The Sears catalog was even good for urban consumers because it meant that they didn't have to shop at the even pricier department stores.
Which sounds, if you think about it, a whole lot like the very successful Amazon business model of today. Daniel Raff is a professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
It is exactly late 19th and early 20th century predecessor of Amazon.
So where did things go so wrong for Sears when they're going so right for Amazon?
The large reasons have to do with the rise of internet commerce and decline of the attractiveness of physical stores.
In 1925, Sears opened its first store. Today, Sears and its sister store, Kmart, have twice the retail square footage of JCPenney. But we shoppers, we don't want stores. We want to shop without leaving home. A model Sears, at least in the old days, was really good at. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Even those who don't spend a whole lot of time reading Vogue couldn't miss the social media hubbub the past couple of days about its most recent issue. It's the one with Lena Dunham on the cover and a big photo spread inside. Pictures that were retouched, photoshopped, kind of obvious because we all know what Ms. Dunham looks like. All of Ms. Dunham, if you've ever watched her show, Girls. So we've done what we do when we have a fashion or a fashion magazine question. We have dialed up Kate Betts. Hey, Kate, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
There's a bunch of stuff I want to get to. The first thing, though, are these Lena Dunham pictures. And the idea that still in this day and age, and with a woman like Lena Dunham, Vogue and other magazines feel the necessity to, and clearly it's a business decision, to alter the images. What's your sense?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, this has been a long-term discussion. We've been talking about it a lot for a long time. And as a former magazine editor, you know, there are things you do for a cover shoot to be able to read the type more clearly. There is a technical issue to it. I think that when it gets a little bit sketchy is when, you know, whole body parts are removed or added or changed in shape and things like that. But I think at this point, you know, image making has changed so much in so many different dimensions that it's hard to really argue with it.
This blew up in part on social media, and then on Jezebel, it got crazy big. They offered the bounty, if you will, for those unretouched pictures. How much has the world of fashion been changed by Instagram and Twitter and all that?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the first step was that fashion itself became democratic. You know, you could buy any look at any price point, H&M, Gap, all of that. And now I think image making has become democratic. You know, we can all alter our own images on choosing the filter on Instagram. People know how to, you know, retouch photos on their computers. So the whole idea of one sort of autocratic voice of how images should be perceived and displayed in the world, that those days are over.
Give me a peek behind the curtain, and granted you weren't there, but as they were putting together this photo shoot in Vogue of Lena Dunham, what was the conversation?
Well, I have no idea.
No, obviously, but you know, give me the benefit of your experience.
You know, I've definitely been on photo shoots before with photographers where they say, oh, don't worry about that, we can fix that in post-production. As they do in movies, too, you know.
And in radio, right? I mean, you know.
And in radio, right. Here, I'm sure you're going to cut out half of what I'm saying right now on the air,
yes,
right,
but you're
Kai?
Going to look good. We're not going to change your body.
But you could change the tone of my voice.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, yeah, they have definite conversations about it, and they definitely have a preconceived idea of how they want the picture to look. You know, some of the most successful magazine cover image makers are the people who have a very clear idea of the way they want the image to look before they even go into the studio.
Does this matter as much with the, all right, so my bias is going to come out here, with the magazine generation, that is to say older consumers of the media and younger millennials who are getting it from blogs and Instagram and Twitter and all that?
Well, I think that's the bigger conversation here because I think the millennials have a very different idea of how they want people to look and what's acceptable to them in image making. You know, because they grew up being able to create their own images on Instagram and with their cell phones, they want real images. I mean, it's really interesting if you see these new ad campaigns that are coming out, like the Dove campaign that was released on Monday.
Right.
And they're unretouched images and the difference between kind of the image and the reality. And I think what's interesting is that millennials really want the real image. And I think that's what the conversation about the Lena Dunham cover was really about. That she's part of that generation,
right,
and she's, you know, bearing it all on her TV show. So maybe people were confused by the fact that she was suddenly, you know, going Vogue on us. Mm-hmm. And they want her to be herself, the way she presents herself.
Yeah. Kate Betts, her book, it's about Michelle Obama, is called Everyday Icon. Kate, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
Forget the actual football game that's going to happen a week from this coming Sunday. The ads are where it's really at, people, and the slow rollout has started. Teasers here and there on air and online of the multi-million dollar spots that are going to air during the game. Nestle, the folks that make Butterfinger bars, are going to be coming out with a brand new candy during the broadcast called Butterfinger Cups. So, you suppose anybody at Nestle ever heard of Reese's, huh? Here's Marketplace's Sarah Gardner.
Step one to challenging an iconic brand like Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, whip up a little controversy. Check out Nestle's online teaser ad featuring Mr. and Mrs. Buttercup, a.k.a. Peanut Butter and Chocolate, seeking couples therapy to spice things up a bit.
Why are we here?
Don't you think it'd be nice to try something new and crunchy?
Followed by some heavy breathing, the phrase, hurt me, and a very long sausage. But I digress. Step two, air a tamer ad during the Super Bowl when millions are watching, and subtly imply that a peanut butter cup could be better. Branding expert Robert Pasikoff.
Where people are either going to say, no, it isn't, but I have to try it in order to be able to say, no, it isn't. Or I can go, wow, it's something different.
Step 3, wait for candy lovers to decide who's got the better peanut butter cup. Georgetown marketing professor Ron Goodstein, for one, tastes trouble ahead for Butterfinger. He says it's like the time Burger King tried to out-French fry McDonald's.
Everybody who walked into Burger King to try them had decided they weren't going to like them before they ever tasted it. Because the one thing you cannot screw with McDonald's is their French fries.
One marketing expert suggested Nestle might just be messing with Hershey's to get the company to spend more money protecting its Reese's turf. But today, Jeremy Vandervoet, Butterfinger's brand manager, denied any such schemes.
Reese's is the number one brand in the category, and they're going to do just fine.
Vandervoet says together they'll all sell more. A rising tide lifting all peanut butter cups? I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today about the Chinese internet. We've all heard about the Great Firewall of China, right? How the web is censored over there. Well, it seems a glitch in all that rerouting that the censoring requires sent about 75% of Chinese internet traffic to a two-story building in Cheyenne, Wyoming the other day. The building on Pioneer Avenue, if you know Cheyenne, is home to a company called Wyoming Corporate Services. Wyoming Corporate Services, in turn, used to be in a building that was the address for a couple of thousand companies, including a shell company owned by a jailed former Ukrainian prime minister, an illicit poker company, and a place that once sold counterfeit truck parts to the Pentagon. And we wonder why our credit cards get hacked, right? All right, we got to go. That's it. Today, the Dow off 41 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ advanced 17 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up a point, basically flat. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.